Peter B. Collins, News and Comment. It's Friday, November 8th, 2013. I got a call from Roger Shuler in jail today, and we got a letter of support for Roger Shuler from Don Siegelman in jail today. That's what leads our News and Comment podcast here.
Sitting in no cell again. I ain't waiting on no bail. 'Cause you ain't drunk no more, you're just cold and sand. And the pepper sprays to hurt real bad. Two criminals are playing cards. You can't sleep a wink 'cause the floor's too hard. Now there ain't no way in hell that I'm going back to jail.
I've never heard of JB and the Moonshine Band before, but I dug this out from the RDO Music Service. It's called Ain't Going Back to Jail. Even got a little reference in there about pepper spray. And my cell phone rang this morning, and when somebody calls you from jail, it's a collect call at egregious rates. I had to set up an account with MCI to prepay it. And finally, I got to hear Roger Shuler's voice. After 16 days of unlawful detention in the Columbiana Jail in Shelby County, Alabama. And if you're new to this story, look up my earlier podcast so I don't have to repeat it all for you. But Roger Shuler is the courageous blogger who has exposed the corruption in the courts and the legal profession in Alabama. And he's paying a price for it. And I want to report to you that Roger is sounding good. He is feisty. He wants to fight. He wants to go directly into federal court to challenge the constitutionality of the injunction against him and the contempt citation that has been holding him now for more than 2 weeks. And just as I was about to sit down to record this podcast, Andrew Craig of the Justice Integrity Project emailed me with a link to the story that he posted at Op-Ed News today and on the Justice Integrity website. I'll link to it in the show file with this podcast. And it's a very powerful personal appeal from Don Siegelman, the former Democratic governor of Alabama who was railroaded into federal prison. And that entire saga was chronicled by Roger Shuler. So that's enough background from me. Let me quote extensively here from Don Siegelman's letter. Roger Shuler has written time and time again, exposing Rob Riley, the former governor's son's, insidious and sinister connections to money-making schemes. Rob Riley, as Shuler told the story, was one of the powers behind the scenes working with Karl Rove and my prosecutor's husband. It was Rob Riley who confidentially confessed to a Republican insider, Dana Jill Simpson, to their manipulation of the Department of Justice to secure an indictment against me, referring to himself, Don Siegelman, so his father could win his race against me for governor. It was Rob Riley, quote, according to Ms. Simpson, who arranged for Siegelman and Scrushy to get a hanging judge. It was Shuler who explained why it was so important to Rob Riley to damage my reelection chances, not only for his father to win, but also so that Rob Riley could make millions off a conviction of my co-defendant, Richard Scrushy. And if you haven't heard, Roger Shuler and I interviewed Richard Scrushy, I believe it was in April of this year. And you can find that podcast simply by entering the name Scrushy, S-C-R-U-S-H-Y, in the search window at peterbcollins.com. Continuing now with the letter from Don Siegelman. Shuler exposed the fact that Riley had weaseled his way into a group of lawyers who were suing Scrushy and his company, Health South. If Scrushy could be convicted criminally, it would make the civil case against Scrushy and Health South much more vulnerable and make the civil case more profitable. It was important to his father's election that I be damaged by the prosecution, and it was imperative that we be convicted so the Rileys could profit from Rob's suit against Scrushy and Health South. Now that Rob Riley has set his sights on running for Congress, Shuler wouldn't let up or shut up. Even though he and his wife were themselves personally in jeopardy, Roger was not to be intimidated by Rob Riley's threats of suing Roger. Riley upped the ante by having Roger Shuler arrested and jailed. Don Siegelman concludes, I call on my friends to send Roger and Carol Shuler money for their legal defense and support. Roger is a courageous journalist with deep-seated beliefs in freedom of the press and freedom of speech. It is our time to show that we, too, have the same commitment to the First Amendment and human rights. People with means, and he names names, like George Soros and Michael Moore, please dig deep to help this embattled family. The rest of us, all of us, please do whatever you can to provide financial support. And also give spiritual support by writing letters to the editor of the Shelby County News, and I would add, write to Roger at the Shelby County Lockup. And Siegelman closes, let them hear from you until Roger is freed and these charges are dropped. Do this for Roger and Carol. Do it for the First Amendment. Do it for yourself and your family. They have been the advocates for justice. It's time for us to be their advocates. Signed, respectively, Don Siegelman, federal prisoner, Oakdale, Alabama. Wow. I am really touched by that. And I'm very glad to see this unlimited expression of support by a man who's been there, who's been victimized by the legal swamp that is the courts and so-called justice system in Alabama. And I hope it touches you in the same way. As I said, I'll link to the article and also put up a link to legalschnauzer.blogspot.com. And if you are financially able and so inclined, I hope you will support the Schulers, as Don Siegelman has so eloquently stated the case. And I always like to thank the people who subscribe to my podcast and support our efforts here, including Janet Price, who doubles down and puts in $10 every month. $5 is the minimum subscription. Jens Ivan Nielsen is a supporter as well. Kathleen Emmer triples. She gives us $15 every month, and she doesn't have to. And Susan Gavet, right here in the Bay Area, is a longtime supporter of this podcast. You can be a supporter, too, and I would encourage you to hop on. I've got a new bonus book offer for you. It's Bill Ayers, Public Enemy. I only have a few copies, so act this weekend. Act right away as soon as you hear this podcast before they're all gone. And in addition to the Bill Ayers book, I've got bags of Kona coffee to stash into your gift package, and we'll send it off to you with your new annual subscription. Go to peterbcollins.com, follow the sign-up link under my picture on the homepage, and it's very easy to set up your PayPal order and get it all going. The other way you can support us is by steering your web business to GoDaddy.com. If you sign up for web hosting with unlimited storage and bandwidth, right now their rates start at under $2 a month, and they'll bonus you your domain name. And to get a screaming deal that benefits the Peter B. Collins Show, be sure to click on the link in the show file for this podcast over at good old PeterBCollins.com. Well, now we head into the apology section of our podcast today, and there are multiple items here. First of all, in an interview with NBC reporter Chuck Todd yesterday, Barack Obama first said that he regrets the problems that have surfaced with the health care plan, the website. He does take personal responsibility for it. And he, after a lengthy answer, finally used the word or the phrase, I'm sorry, for his misleading statements repeatedly. And these were vetted statements. These were part of scripted speeches where he said, if you want to keep your current insurance, you can, period. And he acknowledged that while it's only about 5% of us who buy our own insurance, that's me, that there will be dislocation, that some of us will have policies that don't live up to the standards of the Obamacare law canceled and will be forced to shop in the exchanges or on the open market where rates are skyrocketing. Now, the president didn't really comment on the reaction of the insurance companies and the increases in rates that many people are already seeing starting January 1st. And so I give the president credit for acknowledging his own failings here. And I do understand, as I've said, the box that he is cornered into. That if he admits any weakness and offers up any opening to amend Obamacare, to fix some of these problems, to delay its implementation, to lift the mandates, that Republicans will not help him fix it. They will use that opportunity to scuttle it. And so politically, I have some appreciation for the corner that the president has painted himself into. But we have to acknowledge that it was his brush, his paint, that led him into this corner. And so, that is the first of our apologies today. Thank you, Barack Obama.
Excuse me.
Now, second in the apology corner, here comes Ms. Laura Logan of CBS News, and she was promoted to 60 Minutes because of some of her coverage in Iraq and other war zones. She tried to get to the bottom of the Benghazi story, and today on CBS This Morning, she apologized. She said that, we will apologize to our viewers and we will correct the record on our broadcast on Sunday night. She's referring to a package that she produced and anchored that aired on October 27th related to the attack on the facility in Benghazi, Libya on September 11th of 2012. And Laura Logan presented a guy named Dylan Davies under a pseudonym. And now FBI records have contradicted what Dylan Davies told Laura Logan in 60 Minutes. Basically, he told a story of derring do, that he went to the embassy, scaled a wall, killed one of the attackers. But he had filed a report with his superiors saying that he was at a villa, couldn't get there in time, and had no contact with the scene. There's also a critical point that he says that he saw the dead ambassador when the report said that he did not. Now, to be fair to this guy Davies, who has disappeared and made CBS even further embarrassed, I'm not sure whether what he told 60 Minutes is true or what he told his State Department superiors or the FBI. But the FBI has produced this document that contradicts what Dylan Davies told Laura Logan. So CBS has apologized, and I think that's to their credit. Logan on the morning show today said the most important thing to every person at 60 Minutes is the truth, and today the truth is that we made a mistake. Now, that's rare for a corporate news outlet to do, and again, I find it remarkable. The underlying story remains inexcusable, and CBS should have gotten it right before it broadcast it. Nonetheless, Laura Logan, your apology has been received.
Excuse me.
Now, while we're in the apology zone here, the New York Times lead editorial in Friday's paper makes a good case that Judge Shira Scheindlin of Federal District Court in New York deserves a big apology. And we have reported on this over the past week or so. And in my first report, I simply noted that Judge Scheindlin was accused of improper behavior on the bench. She was removed from the case. And then the appeals court did an unusual thing and basically put her order related to the stop and frisk program in New York City on hold. And so it appears that the appeals court used the pretext of alleged misbehavior by the trial court judge to change the outcome of her ruling. And this is very important. This is not just judicial sleight of hand. This is a Bigfoot by the appeals court that really stinks all the way out here on the left coast. And the Times gives us more information about the allegations against Judge Scheindlin and the fact that the appeals court gave her no opportunity to respond to them, which is the standard procedure. It's damaged the judge's reputation. She's hired a lawyer. Isn't that amazing when a judge has to lawyer up to take on the appeals court that she reports to or that her cases are reviewed by? And this motion filed by her attorneys seeks to vacate the decision by the panel, A, to remove her, and B, to put her ruling on ice. And I think from everything I can see from here that it is highly justified. And the Times shows that the arguments that she exhibited bias are based on extremely flimsy evidence. Today we released an in-depth interview to subscribers at peterbcollins.com. and attorney John Eisenberg returned to our program. He's been a guest many times on other cases, mostly related to the wiretapping case brought here in San Francisco on behalf of an Oregon Islamic charity that was wiretapped and was able to prove it. And Eisenberg regretfully last December had to stop his appeals on that case because he was afraid of setting a bad precedent. And now Ed Snowden has come along and provided standing and documentation for people who believed before that they were wiretapped but couldn't prove it. So now John Eisenberg is working on appeals for prisoners at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. And in August, he filed briefs. In October, he argued them in the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals. Regarding the force-feeding regimen imposed on prisoners who were participating in the hunger strike that started in February and grew to a peak in July, where more than half the prisoners, maybe more, were participating in this hunger strike action at Gitmo. And in this excerpt from our in-depth interview, John Eisenberg describes the legal issues that he is bringing to the court. And while force-feeding is the proximate issue, and he wants to stop the government from forcing food into people who don't want it, and it is their right to reject it, he talks here about the broader impact that his suit could produce. It could overturn portions of the draconian Military Commissions Act of late 2006, early 2007, and its explicit ban, where it prohibited American courts from hearing appeals from prisoners at Guantanamo on issues of confinement, something that I think is clearly unconstitutional, and this may be the case that proves that. Here's John Eisenberg.
The question is, what about the other part of the Military Commissions Act that says they cannot sue over conditions of confinement? That's what we're talking about now, because this litigation over force feeding has to do with how these men are being treated. Now, we have brought it as a petition for a writ of habeas corpus. And our argument is that habeas corpus encompasses these sorts of lawsuits. It's certain types of conditions of confinement are within the scope of the writ of habeas corpus. You cannot use the writ of habeas corpus, for example, to complain that your dinner was chicken instead of fish.
Mm-hmm.
That's not of constitutional dimension. But you can use the writ of habeas corpus to challenge a denial of a constitutional right to a Guantanamo detainee, such as the right to refuse medical treatment or the right to religious free exercise, which is also implicated in this case,
right,
because they were denying them the right to pray communally during Ramadan unless they stopped hunger striking. So in legal context, that's what this lawsuit is now about. Initially, threshold question, can these detainees sue in habeas corpus? Can they obtain a writ of habeas corpus, which Boumediene says they can't do? Can they obtain a writ to challenge at force feeding? Can they use habeas corpus to review this issue? The D.C. Circuit a couple of weeks ago took that issue very, very seriously, and that's mostly what we were discussing. And it is possible when the court rules, it might not rule at all on the legality of the force feeding. It might simply, it might not, but it could just decide the district courts, the lower courts, have jurisdiction
mm-hmm.
to review conditions of confinement of sorts under habeas corpus and send the case back down for further proceedings. If that were to occur, I believe the Obama folks would be extremely upset. This is a holding they want to avoid. So lo and behold, a very interesting thing happened on October 23rd. This is 5 days after our oral argument, when it became evident that there was a real possibility that this court might find jurisdiction
mm-hmm.
in these matters. On October 23rd, the government filed a letter with the court saying, we have now removed the other three men from the force-feeding from the hunger strike list. We no longer consider them hunger strikers, and you will have to determine whether this affects your jurisdiction. Now, when they said this may affect your jurisdiction, that's their way of saying the case is moot, all gone, nothing more to see here, move along, we're not calling them hunger strikers anymore. You don't have a case anymore. Dismiss it.
I invite you to listen to the full interview with Attorney John Eisenberg about the situation at Guantanamo. And we have tagged the interview with a 5 or 6 minute clip. You'll hear the audio there, but also a link will be in the show file, and you can click and see this animated video that is narrated by people in the voice of prisoners at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. And it describes in painful detail what happens when these men are strapped to a chair and force-fed. It's a little bit discomforting, and so if you're queasy about these things, I won't blame you if you decide to pass. But it's something that people really should know, how barbaric it is. And the irrational notion that we need to keep these men alive so they can serve indefinite sentences without charge, without trial, without prospect of release, and that they don't have the right to say, I don't want to eat because it's the only way I can show my objection to this subhuman treatment. Well, there is a potential breakthrough brewing in Geneva, Switzerland, in the talks with Iran over its nuclear programs. Right now, diplomats are flocking to Geneva. They're parachuting in. John Kerry is on his way from, he's been in Egypt and Israel and Palestine and Jordan this week. And it actually looks like there may be the framework for a deal. Problem is, there's a guy named Bibi. And his last name is Netanyahu. But if we just add a Y between the N and the E, I think it really describes Benjamin Netanyahu. Because yesterday, as reports surfaced that the talks were progressing well and that there may be a first stage agreement ready to be announced in the next few days, what we heard from Netanyahu was niet, niet, niet. Now, I know that's Russian and not Hebrew, but you get where I'm going with this. Here's the quote from Netanyahu. If the news I'm receiving of the impending proposal is true, this is the deal of the century for Iran. And he went on to just bloviate about how bad it is and how evil they are and that he can't take it. But President Obama called Netanyahu today, I think to try to calm him down and to explain what is going on in Geneva. And I am cautiously optimistic that we may see a breakthrough. And I will be happy to give John Kerry credit for something, for a change, if he can produce it. Yesterday in Britain, a very rare appearance in public by the three men who run the top secret agencies of the British government. Sir John Saunders, who is the head of the equivalent of the CIA, MI6, appeared before Parliament, along with Ayane Loban, the director of GCHQ, that's their equivalent of the NSA, and Andrew Parker, the head of domestic security, MI5, which is roughly the FBI, under the British structure. And all three of them delivered, how can we call it, contrived and pre-written remarks that were clearly orchestrated and rehearsed and aimed at an American audience. And they all said that Ed Snowden's leaks have hurt security. Now, this is just part of the effort to undermine, the effort to reform the overreach, the very clear overreach of intelligence agencies in the United States. And we're going to get to that in a moment. But I believe that the talking points delivered by these three men were probably not written in Washington, but I'll bet they were reviewed in Washington before they were delivered in London. And this is part of the pretense that they are keeping us safe by looking at our phone records, sometimes listening to our phone calls, intercepting our emails, looking at what we do on the internet. They say that terrorists, and of course they invoked Al-Qaeda, are rubbing their hands together with glee. They say they've intercepted communications from would-be terrorists saying, hey, let's not communicate this way because Big Brother is watching. How stupid do they think we are? Well, the answer is they think we are pretty stupid. They think that we will accept the trade-off of liberty for the false sense of security, of safety. And they keep pushing that message on both sides of the Atlantic. And here's an article that should be in every American newspaper, but of course I found it on the website of the British newspaper, The Guardian, which is in no way perfect. And it's got some sordid episodes in its past. But I credit Michelle Richardson, publishing in The Guardian on Friday, 8 November, where she compares Dianne Feinstein's so-called reform bill that has cleared the Senate Intelligence Committee and one that has some actual reform, the so-called USA Freedom Act, which is introduced in the House by Republican Sensenbrenner and in the Senate by Democrat Pat Leahy. Now, this bill is before the Judiciary Committee in the Senate, where Feinstein also has a seat. But I give this reporter Richardson credit for comparing these two bills and really skewering the Feinstein effort because it's not real reform. She says the legislation would make clear in no uncertain terms that communication records like phone, email, and internet data can be collected without even an ounce of suspicion, pursuant to the so-called privacy rules already in place. Being silent on other types of data like location information or financial records, it passively condones their collection too, but without even the benefit of the paltry protections in place now. For the first time in history, Congress would explicitly and intentionally authorize dragnet domestic spying programs targeting everyday Americans. And that's not all. The Feinstein bill also makes the current situation even worse. It gives the government a 72-hour grace period to warrantlessly spy on foreigners who enter the U.S. without even the Attorney General approval that's currently required. It explicitly states that none of its provisions should be read to prevent law enforcement from digging through massive NSA databases for evidence of criminal activity. By doing so, it authorizes that practice in a roundabout way. And finally, it sets up the prospect for all members of Congress to access important court orders and other information, but then undercuts the requirement by endorsing the current rules that limit that access. So, the Feinstein bill is total bullshit. It is not reform. She's trying to sneak through codification of the illegal, unconstitutional operations that she has personally approved of as chair of the Intelligence Committee, but have never fully been approved by the Congress, at least not with knowledge of the contents. So then the reporter talks about the Freedom Act, USA Freedom Act, and it does have some good elements to it. It would amend the Patriot Act to prevent bulk collection. It would narrow collection of data under the FISA Amendments Act of 2008. That's how they use foreign access to American-based data to collect it. The bill fixes the draconian and unconstitutional gag orders that are put on companies like Facebook or Google so that they can't give basic information to the public about the amount of government surveillance that is imposed on them. But for me, it's still not enough. As you know, I have been repeatedly calling for total dismantling of the FISA court and a renewal of the clear mission statement that the NSA and other intelligence agencies may not operate in the United States. It may not be achievable, but it's what we truly need to rein in the rogue agency. Also, the Senate yesterday, a committee approved a bill which nominally expands whistleblower protection measures to national security whistleblowers. Now, it's far from perfect, but it appears to be a baby step in the right direction. Unfortunately, it still locks in the idea that if you work at the NSA and you want to blow the whistle on some wrongdoing that you observe, you have to report it to the boss at the NSA. It continues to promote the idea that a secret agency or an agency with secret mandates can investigate itself. Now, some of the good items in the bill, it explicitly says that nothing in this bill can be construed to authorize the use of targeted lethal force against a United States person. That is good. And on the whistleblower protection issues, it doesn't apply to contractors, so Ed Snowden would still be in Moscow or Hong Kong or wherever he finally winds up. And Tom Devine, the legal director of the Government Accountability Project, acknowledges, like I just said, that this locks in an institutional conflict of interest. But he said that since it is actually conferring some whistleblower rights on members of the national security community, he calls it a landmark breakthrough, not a final solution, but its passage would be a breakthrough paradigm shift for free speech rights to challenge abuses of power and corruption in intelligence agencies. We'll watch that one, and I will reserve final judgment until I've actually read the bill and learned a little more about it. Yesterday, we reported on Gareth Porter's excellent analysis of the drone strike on November 1st in Pakistan that took out the Taliban leader Massoud. And as we reported from his analysis, by killing Massoud, they also killed the limited prospects for peace talks. Now, there is a split in the Pakistani Taliban, but Massoud seemed to be prevailing and was starting talks with the Pakistani government and was ready to engage in talks, we think, with the Karzai government in Afghanistan. Now, we'll never know if those intentions would have borne fruit in a positive way. What we do know is that the drone strike has caused the succession to Massoud of a man named Mullah Fazlullah. And what is interesting in all of the corporate media coverage about Fazlullah, one of the first references is that he is the hardline commander responsible for last year's attack on Malala Yousafzai, the teenage Pakistani education activist. Once again, my bullshit detector goes off when I see Malala's name injected into a story about the Taliban in Pakistan. And while I have acknowledged that Malala did speak directly to President Obama about drone strikes, and I applaud her for that, I still think she's being used. And her story is used to divert Americans from understanding that the Taliban is a creation of the Pakistani Security Service, the ISI, that it colludes with the Pakistani government at times against the United States. And I also believe that Malala has been used to distract Americans from the drone strikes that kill civilians. Bottom line, the drone strike that we launched last week that settled a score for the CIA by killing Massoud may have been a case where we hurt ourselves more than we hurt the enemy. Thanks for joining me for news and comment. Please share this podcast far and wide and let people know that Don Siegelman supports Roger Shuler.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling until then.